Welcome to the Film Experience. We're back. I'm Nathaniel.
And I'm Mortada. Happy to be back.
And it was a huge weekend. You had a special event, and I spent the whole weekend sitting in a movie theater, so both of us had a good time.
Yes, it was a good week, and I attended the Drama Desk Awards for the very first time, and that was fun to see people like Bruce Wilson and Corbin Blow right there in the same room, even in the same urinal, or next to you on the urinal.
Wait, who was that? Which star do we get to hear?
That was Corbin Blow, who's in Kiss Me, Kate. He was a nominee for Best Featured Actor in a Musical, but he didn't win.
And he didn't get the Tony nomination either.
He wasn't Tony nominated, but André Du Chielt from Haters Down won, and that makes him sort of like the pick for the Tony next Sunday.
Yeah. So for those who aren't familiar, I want to give them a quick rundown of what the Drama Desk is about.
Yes, the Drama Desk Awards is sort of the preamble to the Tonys. So it's a group of writers, critics, broadcasters. The nominating committee is about seven people who watch almost 300 shows a year, Broadway and off-Broadway. They nominate in a lot of categories. That was one thing for attending this show. There were a lot of categories, a lot of sort of costume categories, design categories, even puppeteer categories. So I was like, wow, this is a lot of categories. And then I think it's about 150, 170 people who then are the members of the Drama Desk. Some of them are actors, people in the theater who's been working in the theater or writing about New York theater for years. And those are the members, and they vote for the winners. Mm-hmm. And so The Ferryman was the big winner last night, which is the Sam Mendes-directed play about the Irish Troubles, which Jez Butterworth wrote about basically his wife's family. Laura Donnelly is the star of the show. She wasn't nominated at the Drama Desk Award, but she's nominated at the Tonys. But the play won 5 awards, including Best Play and Best Director. Nobody was there from The Ferryman.
Oh, no. Well, because because the original cast moved on already, right?
Yeah, the original cast is already back probably in the UK. So there was one producer who came at the end of the night to get the big award and said, "We won 5. So, but nobody else was there because they won featured actor, they won director. Anyway, Elaine May won Best Actress in a Play, which means over Heidi Schreck from What the Constitution Means to Me. So I think both of them are nominated Tonys. So I think that means Elaine has the edge there, maybe.
And the word has come down through the grapevine that Elaine May will be attending the Tonys, which is very unusual for her.
Yes.
She's a very reclusive celebrity. So she is actually going to be at the Tonys next weekend.
Wow, that's great, because she hasn't done any interviews, hasn't appeared anywhere except on stage when the play was on.
Yeah.
Kenneth Lonergan was there, and he won for Best Revival. Fiddler on the Roof, which is off-Broadway, won the musical revival. So neither Kiss Me, Kate nor Oklahoma won. And Oklahoma was the most nominated at the Drama Desk. But it only won 2, or maybe 3. It won Featured Actress for Ali Stoker. It won Orchestration and maybe something else. But it was sort of, I was sitting between loud Oklahoma fans and louder Fiddler on the Roof fans. And so I was trying to cheer with the Oklahoma people because I love Oklahoma. But we were always drowned out by Fiddler on the Roof. And they were up for all the same awards, so it was fun that way.
Yeah. So the important distinction between, even though the Drama Desk is a precursor in a way, they also cover off-Broadway, which is why there's a lot of difference in nominations, in addition to having a different nominating committee.
Yes.
So Fiddler on the Roof is not eligible for Tonys. It was a production entirely in Yiddish. Mm-hmm. Well, Yiddish and Russian. And it was very good.
Yes.
Very good show.
Yeah. I think the people who won actor and actress in a musical, Stephanie J. Block for The Cher Show and Santino Fontana for Tootsie, both nominees at the Tony, and they won over some of their Tony competition. The Prom won Best Musical, and that was... it's won over Tootsie, but Hadestown wasn't nominated because it was nominated last year because when it was off-Broadway. So that, yeah, you who knows? It could be the Prom at the Tonys, it could be Hadestown, it could be Tootsie. Mm-hmm. Tootsie won several awards for book and music, which actually was surprising. And I was sitting next to this very funny young woman who did not like Tootsie. So every time Tootsie would win something, she would boo. And since I was sitting right next to her, she was basically booing in my ear, which was funny. And I asked her why she doesn't like Tootsie, but, you know, I think it's a little bit off kilter. Maybe I should not say it.
Okay. I liked Tootsie, but I think The Prom is better.
Yeah. And The Prom was very cute, and they gave, like, a cute speech when they won. And Best Level did, like, a happy birthday to Ethan Slater. I have to say, the Drama Desk Awards, it was a fun night. You could see lots of stars are there. Lots of stars weren't there. People are very loud and sort of, like, you know, they really cheer their shows. But the show is a little bit lo-fi, not just because a lot of things end in, like, Sam Mendes wasn't here, so we accept this on behalf. There were so many of those. But also what I really loved about it is that the musical performances were from off-Broadway plays, so we got a Fiddler on the Roof performance. So you see things that you would not see on the Tony stage. So that was fun just to see the actual performances.
Yeah. Awesome. So stay tuned for the Tonys next weekend when all the stars come out, including their annoying habit of my sound just went out. What's going on here? Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
That's weird. The sound in my ears went out. Apologies. Well, the Tonys are next weekend, and as is their habit, there are a lot of presenters are, you know, movie stars and people who aren't, they're sort of only loosely connected to the theater, rather than getting the theater stars to do those things.
Yes. I mean, the Drama Desk actually did this very well. Like, you know, costume designers presented the costume awards. Scenic designers present those awards. Choreographers, Kathleen Marshall came out and presented the choreography awards. So it was very theater oriented.
Mm-hmm. Great. I was in a wave of theater going a month ago trying to jam in Tony nominees, but I've stopped because I ran out of money to do that.
You can't keep up with New York theater. It's so much. And this is what I discovered yesterday. So many shows. Not only have I not seen them, I haven't even heard of them.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, it was so weird this year is I realized that I knew three of the Drama Desk nominating committee members, and there's only like seven or eight of them, so I know like almost half of them.
Oh wow. Yeah, there's seven. Yep.
Yeah. And so and I was like, oh, that tracks. All three of those people are people who are constantly at shows. Like, you cannot schedule anything with them
daily. Yes.
Yeah. So that, and to me, I love the theater, but I couldn't even do that with movies. Like, I could not go to a movie every day of the year.
Yeah. But you do see a lot of amazing stuff, so I guess.
Yeah.
They manage.
Yeah. But every day you could literally not have a social life. In addition to your work, you would have to be at the theater every night.
But you went to the movies every night this weekend, right?
I did, yeah. So we have a lot of movies to talk about. I love going to the movies very regularly, but I don't go every day of the year.
Yeah, I think I went twice this one day this weekend, maybe Saturday. I saw two movies, and then because we had to keep up.
Where should we even start?
Well, let's start with Rocket Man, because that's, you know, we're queer, we're here, let's talk about Elton John.
Okay, by the time this podcast is up, you will have all seen my review, and it's a rave. I completely loved it. I was very pleasantly surprised, because I wasn't going in expecting that much, other than, you know, assuming correctly that it would be easily better than Bohemian Rhapsody. But what I didn't know is that I would just love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm less enthused about it. Basically, my feeling about it were a little bit of schizophrenic. I found some of it delightful and amazing and just so fantastic, and some of it cringeworthy. There were things that I was just like, I can't believe this is in this movie. Why is this scene so bad?
For example, you can puncture my love, because it's very new. It's a very new love.
The framing device was terrible, and every time they went back to it, I just couldn't believe it. The framing device is that it starts with him going and crashing into a group therapy session. These poor people cannot even talk about their what's ailing them. They just have to listen to Elton going on.
Nobody's buying a ticket to their movie, Murtada.
So why do this framing device? And the poor, like, sort of, I can't even call them actors. They're like, sometimes they're even out of focus. And they just took me out whenever they would be in focus. I'll be like, oh, look at them looking at him. It really took me out. I thought those scenes were terrible.
I was actually surprised, because when it started, I thought the opening joke, because that's the very first scene in the movie where he walks into the therapy room. Mm-hmm. I thought that opening joke was super funny, because you expect him to go on stage because he's all like dressed up. And so I thought the joke was really funny, but then as soon as I realized that it was the framing device, my mood was like crashing. I was like, oh no, this is going to be so embarrassing and cringy. But then I actually thought it was funny. Like, I think because we didn't stick with it very often. And when we came back to it, it was always in very small doses. And I think that you have to have, like, I should put a little disclaimer on my love. I think you have to have some sort of affinity for or understanding of self-care and therapy to not be annoyed with that. Because it does all, even though it's just a framing device and they are away from it most of the time, it does all come back to there and sort of the dramatic climax.
Yes, where every person in his life comes to the therapy session and they tell him how much they love him.
Well, not exactly, but yeah.
So that is really, I just thought the whole thing was like analyzing Elton was psychology 101. And it's like, it could have been any person. Like, the costumes and the songs are definitely, this is Elton John, you see him. But the whole psychology of his life and his daddy issues and his mommy issues was like, it could be anybody. It was psychology 101. They tell you, oh, your dad didn't hug you, so you're looking for love all your life. It's just like...
Well, I will say this about that. Yes, it's very broad, but it is a, you know, musical.
Mm-hmm.
So I was less concerned with the broadness of the psychology and more concerned with, like, the spectacle and the general feeling of it. And, like, I thought all of the, like, the sentimental stuff about, you know, like, looking for love and all that, I think that played out in a way that felt more akin to pop music, where it has to be kind of broad and simple to relate to and engage with. So I thought it was really a smart, fun, you know, moving movie. But I get why it would annoy some people.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the delightful things, let's move on to the things that delighted me. Like, I would say most of the songs were just really delightful. Like, when when they do, is it Honky Cat, which they do as sort of like Elton falling in love with Joan Reed, but also falling in love with shopping. And it's done so beautifully. And that was a highlight and very delightful, even if it is a bit consumerism, but it's fine, whatever. That's Elton John. That was really fun. Saturday Night was really fun when they did it with younger Elton growing up into Taron Egerton and his whole little town singing. That was really cute. So there were like really, really highlight, you know, delightful. Every time they staged the song, it was a highlight.
Yeah. And I thought even like the stuff that, you know, you're a little iffy on, like the, you know, psychological stuff, I even thought the way that worked in the music was really smart. Like, one of the earliest songs in the movie is I Want Love, which is one of my favorite Elton songs. And I thought the staging of that was incredible. It was simple, but it begins with his whole family in the same room. And as they sing their verses, they sort of walk away from each other. So I thought that was a great illustration of, like, you can want something, but you yourself can't give it or take it from the people that you're asking it from. Or, you know, sometimes family is not, sometimes you have to choose your own family. Sometimes your family is not where you're going to get that. So I liked that in a lot, that number. And so I think that set up the ending really well, where sort of the people come back to his life in sort of a like metaphoric way. But anyway, it's a big spectacle, so if you like big glitzy musical numbers, there's plenty of those.
And if you love Bryce Dallas Howard, I mean, I know this is like the basic sort of homosexual reaction. You go to a movie of an ensemble of mostly men and you love the actress, but I don't care. My favorite was Bryce Dallas Howard, who I thought as Elton's mom was just so arch, so funny, so camp. And I was just delighted every time she, like, looked at him with disdain and told him off. And it was great. I loved her.
I thought she was a little broad. But yes, camp. She was fun. Like, every time I saw her, I thought she was fun. But I thought I sort of have issues with her as an actor in general. So I was like, okay, Bryce, I get what you're going for. And at least it's fun. Because a lot of times she's dull in movies.
Yeah, she was very fun.
But, you know, nobody goes to, as I said in the review, nobody goes to a biopic for the supporting cast.
Yes.
It all comes down to Taron Egerton, who's incredible in this. Like, so, like an exhaustive performance. He's doing so much all the time. And I don't mean that in a, like, over-the-top way. I mean, he just really committed to this. Like, you could feel it in every frame. I thought he was great.
I wanted to ask you something since you brought up Bohemian Rhapsody earlier. And we, you know, listeners of the podcast know both our issues with that movie. But I wanted to ask you if it bothered you that the movie sort of slut-shames Elton and presents him hitting rock bottom in that staging of Benny and the Jets in an orgy. Because to me, that reminded me of sort of the gay shaming of Freddie Mercury in Bohemian Rhapsody. It wasn't as much of that, but that particular scene really bothered me. So did it bother you?
It didn't, and I'll tell you why. Because it normally would, but the reason that it didn't is because it was leveled off with enough, like, they never, ever were couching the fact that he was a gay man, and that a lot of who he is that. And so, like, for example, his relationship with, I forget the guy's name, played by Richard Madden.
John Reed.
John Reed was played in such a way where even though it was like a toxic relationship, you felt the sort of joy of, like, their first sex scene is one of the, like, most sex positive scenes I've seen in a movie when it comes to gay sex. Like, because, like, Elton's obviously enjoying it. He's obviously coming into who he is.
Yes.
Because he's been resisting it, you know? So I thought that leveled off the sort of you know, ooh, the red lighting, which I complained about in Bohemian Rhapsody too.
And it was back here,
yeah. But it, but in Bohemian Rhapsody, there was nothing else. It was just like, oh, his hedonism is so terrible. Yeah. And all the other band members are angels.
Yeah.
Heterosexual angels with wives that they go home to. They've never done drugs or anything.
Yeah. I mean, that's that sort of staging of that song, coupled with sort of Elton's publicist approved end credits of he is now properly loved and has a husband and two kids, which is sort of like heteronormative. Just that, it really bothered me a little bit. He's slut shamed for being, you know, a gay promiscuous man, and then look at him now, he's doing so much better. Just one man.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't really bother me. I think because, again, I really felt that the movie was not sending a negative message about gay love. It was sending out this message that he was trying to find it and didn't quite know where to find it from. Yeah. Which I think is totally valid. Like, a lot of people go through that, you know. Yeah. And a lot of people do hit rock bottom with sex and drugs in real life, you know. But yeah, I get what you're saying. So if you're hypersensitive to that, as I sometimes am, if I don't see the leavening effects of other ways of looking at it, then yeah, it's a little troublesome.
Yep. One final thing I want to say about Rocket Man, I would, Vulture that just published this thing. It's very funny. It's one of those quiz things, and it says, does this scene appear in Bohemian Rhapsody, Rocket Man, or both? And just go do that test. We'll put the link in the post. And it's so funny. And the answer to most, I'm just going to give it away because that's the joke. The answer to most, I think maybe 90% of the questions, is the scene appears in both.
Well, yeah, it's musical biopic. They both take place in the 70s. They're both about queer men. Yeah, yeah.
But yes, it's so funny in that they're telling exactly the same story. Even Joan Reed is a character in both movies.
Yeah. What'd you think of Jamie Bell?
I really liked him. I liked Jamie Bell. I thought he was great. I would have liked a little to understand a little bit about Bernie Taupin. Mm-hmm. I loved sort of the staging of Tiny Dancer as Bernie Taupin coming into his own in LA and, mm-hmm. you know, finding love with that one gorgeous woman, but we never see her again. And we never actually get, he does come back and they do sort of that song where they break up and come back together, John and Bernie. But I did want to understand a little bit more, especially because he wrote all these lyrics, right?
Yeah.
So I would have liked to see inside of, like, how these lyrics inspired both their lives. I think they did it with Your Song very beautifully when they were living together and writing. And that was so beautiful, to that scene where he comes down and gives him the lyrics and he goes, you know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
So gorgeous. But I wanted more of that because he's the partner, right? He's his real artistic partner.
Yeah, I agree that it's a little disappointing in that respect because, you know, I would count myself as only a casual Elton fan. Like, I have met super fans of Elton and I am not one because they are crazy, as most super fans of anybody are. There's a lot of things about his career that I didn't know. I knew the songs, you know, but one of the things that was always, as a very casual fan, it was always hard to me to remember that he was the musician or the composer rather than the lyricist.
Yeah.
Because so many of the songs sound like they might be autobiographical about Elton, but that doesn't make sense at all. That, which is why it would have been nice to see more of their collaboration, because why do Bernie Taupin's lyrics sound so much like Elton's life when it was Bernie writing them rather than Elton?
Yeah. And it was, and even the way in the movie, it's not presented like they are tossing ideas or anything. It's just Bernie goes and writes and gives him the lyrics.
Yeah.
And he puts the song. So it's already done. The lyrics are already written.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I really liked their chemistry and rapport in the movie, so I wish there had been more of that.
Yeah.
But I also, as much as I love the movie, I just like, enough with Jamie Bell playing second fiddle to other people. He's so great in everything. Why doesn't he get leading roles all the time? It's frustrating for me.
Well, he got a leading role this year in Skin, and nobody wants to talk about that one.
Well, the short won the Oscar, Murtada.
The most terrible movie I saw at Tribeca was The Long Skin. But anyway, let's not talk about
that. I didn't
that.
Even know you saw that. You didn't write anything for the site.
I was horrified by it. I couldn't. It would have been like the biggest pan to end all pans.
Okay. Well, you know people like to read those as well. But no matter. The time is bad.
I can write it when it comes out. I don't even know when it comes out.
So
we'll talk about it then.
So moving on, a complete change of pace. Let's say Booksmart.
Yes, this was like a funny movie. Booksmart. Beanie, you know how much I love Beanie and Beanie Feldstein in Lady Bird. So I was excited to see her lead a movie.
Yeah, and she was great. And Caitlin Dever, I think best performance ever from Caitlin Dever. It was so funny. I saw those movies. Well, I saw Ma in between them, which we'll talk about in a minute. But Rocketman and Booksmart are my two favorite movies of the year so far, I think.
Wow. Booksmart is funny. It's like sort of like it follows the tried and true one night before you leave high school sort of plot, right? Mm-hmm. So they're leaving high school. They suddenly discover that, you know, they were too book smart and didn't have enough fun. So they want to cram all the fun into one night and hilarity ensues.
it's a formula to get to the hilarious jokes and the great performances.
So that's what I didn't like about it. It was very formulaic. Like, you could tell exactly where it's going, but most of the time it was funny. The performances were great. So it was a fun time. Who I really loved, though, it was the small part played by Billy Lord, playing this sort of crazy friend of theirs who just appears out of nowhere whenever you expect her. You never expect where she just appears and does some crazy thing and just goes away. And it was just so funny and delightful whenever she appears.
Yeah, she's like a trust fund girl who's insane and seems to teleport because wherever they end up, that's where she is. She was really funny.
Yeah. But I have to say, you know, going back to performances, I was maybe because my expectations for Beanie were just so much. I did not love her. I thought she was a little flat. And it's just, I don't know, like I thought Caitlin Dever was great. And maybe that's because Caitlin gets sort of a bigger arc. She has to play falling in love and getting her heart broken and all of that. And she, you know, those scenes really help her. But I don't know. I can't even pinpoint why I didn't react to Beanie, but it could be just my expectations. I just thought she was a little flat.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Beanie needs to just be the sidekick, which is a terrible thing to say. But
I mean, I thought that their chemistry as like a comic duo was through the roof. The two of them. I just love them together in every scene.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the direction? Do you think this is it's a movie that we're going to see more from Olivia Wilde?
I would say this is one of the reasons I liked it so much, is it felt like an actual movie, not like, oh, an actor's directing a movie. Like, I mean, I hate to pinpoint somebody, but this is someone I thought of during it because it was also like a light comedy, was Elizabeth Banks with Pitch Perfect 2, where I got no sense ever that Elizabeth Banks knew how to direct, even though I love her as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Olivia Wilde, this actually feels like if I didn't know it was a celebrity who directed it, I would have just thought, oh, this is a really promising comic director. because there's lots of visual flourishes. It has great rhythm and tempo and has these weird mood shifts that I think really work. Like, there's one scene where Caitlin dives into this pool, and that whole sequence
was
so interesting because it risks all these weird idols and a mood shift, and then it goes into another abrupt mood shift when she emerges from the water. And I just, the whole thing felt like directed to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very impressed.
Yeah, I think it's very confidently directed. And she stages, like, there's a lot of sort of hijinks, and they're all staged well, and they're very believable. I think she's going to have a big career, and maybe a better career as a director than as an actor.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, no offense to Elizabeth Banks. Not everybody is meant to be a director.
Poor Elizabeth Banks. I hope she doesn't listen to this podcast.
I'm sorry, Elizabeth. I love you. It was just who came to mind because I was thinking of light comedy, like female light comedy, and I was trying to think of something comparable, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and also we talked about this last podcast, like Ralph Fiennes.
Oh yeah,
he's a great actor. He wasn't maybe wasn't meant to be a big director because he's kind of like a dull director.
Yes, for sure.
But yeah, I thought I would happily see something else that Olivia Wilde directed.
Yes, and you know what? Maybe Beanie should do drama. I want Beanie to do a drama next, and I'm waiting to fall in love with her again because I still love her in Lady Bird so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What we say about Booksmart really quickly? I will say that I liked that all of the characters started out as two-dimensional, but by the end you sort of feel more complex feelings about all of them, even though they're all like high school stereotypes.
Yes.
In the first scenes. So I thought that worked well about the movie, too.
Yeah, there were things that were sensitively drawn. Like, for instance, the minor part of the girl that Caitlin Dever has a crush on. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, without her being on screen, you sort of see who she is by the end. Even though all we hear is just Caitlin talking about her with Beanie. So there were things there that were done well.
Mm-hmm.
There were other things that I was like for instance, the guy who Beanie has a crush on is such a stock character. He's played by Cuba Gooding Jr.'s son.
I really liked him. I thought this is who I was thinking of when I mentioned that. He has a scene with Beanie. I didn't know that was Cuba Gooding Jr.'s son, but like he has a scene with Beanie toward the end where you suddenly see him as like a fuller person because you're not thinking of him as this complete empty, like popular jock. You're like, oh, he has, you know, weird idiosyncrasies like anyone, and maybe sees her more fully as a person than you thought he did.
Mm.
Even though he's still essentially the same person she initially thought he was.
Yeah. I don't know. To me, he read like just the stereotype of the jock, and there was the stereotype of the guy going to like the math genius who's going to work at Google, and another stereotype of like, so I wasn't as enthused about the supporting characters. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even calling them supporting because they were literally just stereotypes.
Joke machines.
Yes. They were not characters at all. So that is one of the things that I think the script doesn't do well.
Agree to disagree. I was so pleasantly surprised. And I had heard that the movie wasn't doing well. At least here in New York, it was doing well. My screening was so jam-packed. There wasn't like an empty seat. And this was not the first weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It was like so crowded and people were roaring with laughter the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a fun movie, and it's a fun time. So, yeah, I don't, I mean, but it's also a movie that I think people, you know, we don't have to talk about the box office because there have been so many articles and controversies about it, but whatever. But it sounds like maybe it just went wide too early and opened at the wrong weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also maybe it's just more of an urban movie. It's for big cities, you know.
Yes.
So anyway, there's that. Let's talk about a really weird movie, Diamantino, briefly.
Yes. So
you just had an interview at the site with the directors.
Yes. It was such a good interview and they really liked to talk about it. It's such a crazy movie. I don't even think I can like say what it is about because it's a hodgepodge of everything. But this is the one from the movies we're talking about today that I will unabashedly say, go see it. This is a great movie. It's unlike anything you will see. It's set in Portugal, so it's in Portuguese, but it's about this footballer sort of inspired by Cristiano Ronaldo, but maybe not. And he's sort of asexual, but then he becomes a lesbian. I think that's all I need to tell you. You have to go see this journey. And it's about Brexit, and it's about these crazy, nefarious, evil sisters who are trying to usurp his power and take his money from him. It's crazy. Just go see it. It's so good.
It's so hard to describe, and it's kind of every genre. But the sort of... I would say that the most descriptive genre is sort of a political satire, maybe.
Yes, yes.
Even though the politics are a little hard to read because it's just so fucking weird as a movie. but it's also, there's lots of eye candy because the lead, Carlotto Cota, is gorgeous. And he plays this very dumb, very famous jock who's sort of the fun part of that is he's sort of not aware of his narcissism, which is a really interesting take on like a super famous person who sleeps in their own merchandise, essentially. His pillows have his own face on them. So it's a really weird movie, but it's so funny.
So crazy. And it's like you can never guess where it's going. Just you can't because the premise is crazy and then it just goes crazier as it goes along.
Yeah. It's from Portugal, although Murtada and I both met the directors, but they're both not Portuguese.
They're American.
So somehow they end up making a movie in Portugal. I don't even remember the story behind that, but it's in Portuguese and it's a very funny movie.
Yeah, I think one of them lives in Portugal and lives and works there.
Yeah.
So go see it. It's in New York and now, but I think they're expanding.
Yeah, on the official website, they have a list of cities. So there's quite a few cities it's going to this summer. So if you're interested, which you should be, because it's just, you have to see it to believe it, essentially.
Yeah.
And you probably heard about it briefly at Cannes last year. This is one of the problems I find with the Cannes Film Festival. Like, these very sort of idiosyncratic international movies get a lot of attention, and then they don't arrive in theaters till a year or a year and a half later, and people have totally forgotten what they might have heard about them.
Yeah, and it won the Critics' Week Prize, so this was a movie that people liked at Cannes.
Yeah. But it was a whole year ago, and I haven't heard anybody talking about it, you know, since it came out. But it's worth seeing.
Yes, for sure. Which I wouldn't say about Ma. I don't know what you thought of Ma.
Our final movie of the week. You know, I went into it. I don't think I have to put this disclaimer on, although I always do. I'm not into horror movies. So I went into it hoping for like a sort of like a fun thriller, maybe a little campy. And I went solely for Octavia Spencer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, and because I heard Missy Pyle was in it, too. And I love Juliette Lewis. So I was like, oh, fun actresses. And I know Tate Taylor is an actual actress sexual, obviously, the director.
Yeah.
Because he also made The Help and...
Girl on the Train, the masterpiece.
Girl on the Train. And so you'll see a lot of his favorite actors in it, like Missy Pyle he's worked with before. Allison Janney has a bit part. So I was hoping for just like a fun thriller, and I didn't. It was okay, but like I forgot about it very quickly. Like it was easy, fun watch. Like it had a lot of like scenes that popped, but as like a whole movie, I can't say run out and see this. You know.
Yeah, I agree with that. So I mean, it's about this woman who befriends these teenagers and then basically goes to town because she's a crazy loner. So I agree with you in that there were a couple of jolts, but this is like a horror movie, and like sort of with the premise and the performance, it's supposed to be a funny horror movie, but it was not fun. And there were not a lot of jolts. There was not a lot of real horror. I think part of the problem with me with the pacing, it spends 2/3 of the movie on the setup.
Yeah, it really does. It takes a long time to get to the horror part.
Yeah, and the first time, like her first victim, that was so much fun. And it comes out of nowhere and you're really surprised by it. And it's just like, whoa, okay, this has happened. And you're like, that was fun. So can
Are you talking about the car scene?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
And I was like, okay, this is fun. I snap to attention now, and I'm like, can we get more of that? And then you don't really. And then because I think it does this thing where it gets gun shy at the end in all of the setup. They just get gun shy and don't pull the trigger. Like that scene between Octavia Spencer and Luke Evans, where we don't want to spoil it, but if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about, where she's checking him out and the movie's saying she's going to do something horrible and she doesn't do it. And it just becomes a flat thing. And that was the whole thing with the movie. She never, like, the writers and Tate Taylor never commit to go full horror.
Well, I think there was a little bit of hedging of bets in terms of how much we would still love Octavia if she was doing all these really awful things.
Yeah.
But she does do pretty awful things. But one of the odd decisions is that at least one of the most violent things is completely off screen. And I was like, why is that off screen in a horror movie?
Right? Exactly.
I won't spoil what it is, but somebody that dies in the movie is completely off screen.
Yeah. So it's just like, I'm like, why is this movie at the final thing of supposedly delivering what we're here for doesn't deliver it? They just stop.
But it does have a lot of scenes that pop, though, and a lot of weird moments that, even if they're slightly predictable, pop, for lack of a better word. Like, toward the climax, when all of the people are sort of imprisoned, that's all I'll say about it. Like, that scene was pretty gross and also entertaining in a weird way.
I was not entertained at all by this movie. And I think also the sort of the acting, Octavia is great, but I think the supporting cast, especially the young kids, are kind of not great. Especially the lead. She's the lead because the movie starts with her. Like, she's the lead of the kids. Juliette Lewis's daughter, whose name is, she's a new actor. Her name is Anna Silvers. She's also in Booksmart. But I just thought she was completely vacant on screen.
Yeah, it definitely had the horror movie problem of the teenagers being sort of interchangeable.
Yeah.
They didn't have strong enough personalities to sort of carry individual arcs at all. Which is a little too bad because like the setup is such that they could have done that, I think. Mm-hmm. They could have had more meat for each of those characters. Mm-hmm. Especially since the movie took so long on the setup. Like there was plenty of opportunities to give them full lives.
And also, did you notice how cheap this movie is? It's basically set, and I wouldn't have noticed this if, like, there was nothing to look but notice these things, because it is set in, like, two or three places. And, like, I don't think they even had the money to go inside the school. Most of the scenes of these teenage kids in school are set in the school car park.
So, oh, yeah, like, that's true. I didn't even think about that while watching it. It is very, like, well, that's always one of the reasons why horror movies continue to be made, hundreds of them, because they're usually cheap and they usually turn a profit.
Yes. So, yeah, but it's just like, okay. I mean, I'm happy to see Octavia sort of play something different and sort of, like, take the lead in this way in a movie. And she seems in interviews to be so happy to play against Stipe. So that's great for her, but it's just not a good movie.
I will say the scene I was most disappointed in, and I don't think this is a spoiler, was between her and Luke Evans. When they go out for a drink together at a bar. Because you're sort of, you don't know where that particular scene is going. You know it's not going to go well because it's a horror movie, but you don't really know how, in what way it won't go well. And the sort of shift in that scene came out of nowhere for me. Like, I didn't buy any second of that scene.
Yeah. And also, like, this movie is about a black woman terrorizing these mostly white teenagers because she was terrorized by people when she was their age. And the movie sort of, there is a very good review in The New Yorker from Doreen St. Felix. And basically she talks about how Ma promises that this sort of racial tension will be pivotal and then just ends up it being completely inconsequential. So read that review. I really thought she made some great points about that.
So we don't have that much else to say about Ma, I guess. I mean, it's an easy sit. Like, if you like, campy thrillers or whatever, I think it's enjoyable in some ways. Some people obviously really liked it.
Yes.
Just not Mercada. And I wouldn't recommend it is just, it's so not my genre that unless something is really good, I just tend to not respond that much.
Well, Octavia Spencer is my genre, so you can see how disappointed I am that this wasn't better.
But it is an easy sit, especially if you like the actors, because Octavia, Juliet, Missy Pyle, there's fun stuff in the movie.
I have to say Missy Pyle has a scene where she's drunk. She's very, very funny. So she plays drunk so well, and I love that scene. And, it's really good. And it's really good when Octavia sort of, takes care of her. That was my favorite bit.
Yeah, anyway, so it's a mixed review on Ma, but thumbs up for Rocket Man and Booksmart.
And Diamantino. Lots of movies. Well, the summer is getting to be better. I have to say, like we talked about last May, there weren't as many movies, and there were definitely not as many good movies. So,
well, yeah.
Picking up.
And this is the big problem with Disney being such like a monolithic corporation now. Part of the problem with the summer movie season is like every studio doesn't want to compete with Disney. So like you had all this gap around Avengers Endgame, and then all this gap last on a holiday weekend, nothing wanted to challenge Aladdin. So then everything gets in this weekend and there's all these great options, but it's just like, it's so uneven in terms of going to the movies. Cause if some preordained blockbuster is coming out, every studio just tries to steer clear.
Yeah.
So you end up in this really like bumpy, like if you're a weekly moviegoer, it can be very frustrating because you might have three things you want to see one weekend and then nothing for a few weeks.
Yeah. There are two movies coming out in next week in limited release, but one of them goes wide just the week after immediately that I saw at Sundance. and are pretty fucking fantastic. The Last Black Man in San Francisco, and Late Night with Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling. So there is exciting.
Both next weekend, yeah.
Yeah. So there's exciting stuff coming up for sure.
But they're both in Limited next weekend, correct?
Yes, but Late Night goes wide the weekend after.
Yeah.
So it's only Limited one weekend.
Yeah.
So that's good news for people who are looking forward to that.
Yeah. Coming out for my birthday, almost.
Oh, wow. It's June.
Send me gifts, everyone, June 6th.
Oh, wow, that's just around the corner.
Yeah. But basically, it's my birthday month. I always say that. June is just like, happy birthday to Nathaniel all month long.
Okay. Do you want to give listeners a preamble to, I think next week you have a SmackDown podcast, right?
I should say the SmackDown was supposed to be this weekend, but we had some scheduling difficulties with the blog. You know, we did have those 2 days we were down and we got really backed up. The site went down. Not our fault. A little Squarespace issue. And then we had some scheduling things. So it's either next weekend or the week after. But regardless, there will be 2 SmackDowns this month because, like, I have people scheduled. And when you have guests on the panel, you have to still do them. So we will – 2 SmackDowns this month. We will have 2001. So rewatch Gosford Park, which is streaming now for free. And Iris is also streaming for free. So – there's 2 of the movies out of the way. And at the very end of the month, last weekend of the month, we will have 1960, which should be really fun.
Yes.
And I will announce on the podcast, one of the panelists you could look forward to, Leslie Headland, the writer-director of Russian Doll. She'll be joining us for that one.
For 1960, right?
Yeah, because we both love Psycho, so, you know.
All right, that is. Her show is great.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening and hope you enjoyed our conversation and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah. And, next weekend, make sure to watch the Tony Awards because we will have to discuss that as well.
Yeah. I can't believe it's the Tony Awards versus Big Little Lies. What a Sophie's Choice.
It's like they don't even know the gays. Well, you can record one and watch the other.
Yes.
My rule of thumb on that is whatever's live is the thing you watch. So that's the Tony Awards. But then I will chase it with Big Little Lies the same evening.